Thought there was going to be a reading there. I'll read tonight. You have a Bible? Colossians 4 is where we're going this afternoon. Colossians chapter 4. It's great to see everybody this afternoon. Hope you had a good afternoon after our gathering today, and glad that we can be together for a few minutes tonight. Very much enjoyed being with you this morning. Thank you so much for the very kind reception that you gave me this morning among you. You all are so gracious and hospitable. You certainly make a visitor feel very welcome among you, and for that, I'm very grateful. Enjoyed being with you this morning. Much enjoyed the gathering today that we had at the park a great deal as well. That's a beautiful area out there. Enjoyed that so very, very much. It's wonderful to be with you. I love Indiana. I lived in Indiana for 12 years, 6 years down in the southern part of the state and 6 years here in the greater Indianapolis area. And so I always enjoy coming back here very, very much. I particularly miss the spring and the fall in Indiana very much. I like the Florida, I like the winter in Florida, but the other three seasons are all summer, and it never changes. Somebody asked me a while back, they said, Don, do the trees change color in Florida in the fall? And I said, well, yes, they do. They change from dark brown or dark green to light green, and that's about all the color change that we get. Nothing like you enjoy in the beautiful state of Indiana. Good to be with you all tonight. I want us to read a little bit in Colossians 4, but it's going to take us 2 or 3 minutes to get there tonight. I want to talk for just a moment about what you see on the screen, and I know, ladies and gentlemen, that when you read that it makes an audience a little bit nervous. I think probably an audience sees that title and thinks, great, here's another preacher who's going to make us feel guilty because we're not doing enough to try to teach others the gospel. I want to tell you tonight that I am not now, nor have I ever been much into drive-by guiltings. That's not who I am, and it's not what I do. But I do want to talk to us a little bit tonight about some very practical, tangible things that perhaps we can do to help us along this line. For the past almost 2 decades now, John Grisham has been one of the most prolific and popular writers of fiction in our nation. He has sold somewhere in the vicinity of 250 million books. Can you imagine that? 250 million books. I believe that I've read every single one of his fiction novels except for the last, and I'm about halfway through it now. His very first novel was a book entitled A Time to Kill. It really didn't sell very well at all. It sold only 5,000 volumes, which in the literary world really is almost nothing at all. His next book was entitled The Firm, and The Firm really wasn't selling any better than A Time to Kill. But as people began to read The Firm, they really, really liked it. And so they began to investigate about Mr. Grisham, and they read about him, and they liked him. And so they began to tell others, who told others, who told others. And eventually The Firm sold 7 million copies. And what was interesting then is that the people who read The Firm and liked it went back and began to read A Time to Kill, and it became a bestseller as well. And it all happened because people who read the book liked the book, and they liked the author of the book, and they told others. And I want to ask you tonight, does that have anything to do with what we ought to be about in evangelism? Well, certainly it does. But let's take that a step further tonight. Let's imagine tonight that you have a son or a daughter who is a very gifted writer, and they really believe that they would like to make their life's work trying to be an author. And imagine if Mr. Grisham were to call you and say, you know, a friend of mine has given me some of your child's writings, and they really do have a talent here, and so here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to come, and for a few days, I'm willing to mentor your child in the art of writing. How valuable would that be? Or imagine that you have a child who is a golfer in high school, and you have a son who's really a wonderfully talented golfer. He's not just a duffer, but he really has skills. And imagine if Roy McIlroy, who was named the golfer of the year for 2019, imagine if he were to call you and say, you know, I've seen some tape of your son playing golf, and he really does have some skill, and so I'm willing to come and play a few rounds with him and try to mentor him in his craft. How valuable would that be? Well, that would be invaluable, because you're just learning from someone who really is the best at their craft. Well, when it comes to evangelism, we get to learn from the best. I mean, when God Almighty looked down from heaven and he chose an evangelist to send around the world, to use our vernacular, a personal worker to impact countless lives. He chose a man named Saul of Tarsus. And in fact, that was the language that God used. God said, you're going to be a chosen vessel of mine. And so if you want to know about evangelism, he's just one of the finest examples you could ever follow. And so we could open our Bibles and we could begin in Acts chapter 13 and we could read stories from three missionary journeys, and there are countless stories there of success and failure. And there's much to learn from both. But it seems to me that Paul really gives us a synopsis of evangelism in Colossians 4, beginning in verse 2. Do you have your Bible tonight? Let's read together there, please. Colossians 4, beginning in verse 2, if you will. Listen to what he says. He says, I want you to continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving, and meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Let's stop right there. When I read that passage, I don't know what you see. What I see when I read that passage is that it seems that the Apostle Paul takes the experience from years of missionary travels and conversations with literally thousands of individuals, and he distills the essence down into three imperatives. Now, I want us to talk about those three imperatives very quickly tonight. And I want you to notice as we talk about them that they really don't have anything at all to do with methods or systems or marketing or selling or closing the deal. Now, I think sometimes we'd like to have that. I think sometimes what we would like is for God to give us the perfect open and the perfect close that we could seal the deal, and then we could just baptize everybody in the world. But it doesn't work that way. Because Paul said we have to think about each one, because people are individuals. And so what I want to do in the minutes that we have tonight, in the first half of our lesson, I want to just talk about these three imperatives that I see in this passage. And then in the second half, what I'd like to do is talk about four things that everybody can do in evangelism. And it doesn't matter if you're 8 or 18 or 80. It doesn't matter if you have a PhD or if you didn't finish high school. It doesn't matter if you're a brand new baby Christian or if you've been a Christian for 60 or 70 years. It doesn't matter. There are four simple things that everybody can do in evangelism. And I want to share those with you as we close tonight. So let's begin with looking first at Colossians 4, beginning in verse 2 through 5, and it seems to me that Paul says, look, here are three things that we need to think about with evangelism. Here they are. Number one, he said, I want you to consider your God. Consider your God. Now, here's where he said that. He said, meanwhile, I want you to pray. Pray also for us, that God would open a door to us for the word, to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I also am in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. And so Paul says, first, I want you to involve God in this process. It's amazing to me that Paul begins and he says to the Colossians, look, I need your help in evangelism. That's amazing to me. That Paul says, I need you to help me in evangelism. And he says, here's what I need you to do. I need you to pray for me. I need you to pray for me. Now, Paul saying that he needs help in evangelism to me would be like LeBron James coming to me and saying, Don, could you show me how to shoot a jump shot? I think he knows how to do that. To me, that would be like Peyton Manning when he was in his prime here in Indianapolis. It would have been like Peyton Manning coming to me and saying, Don, could you show me how to read a defense or maybe to throw a football? I think he already knows how to do that. And here is the Apostle Paul. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Apostle Paul. He is Holy Spirit-filled, a brilliant scholar, a seasoned veteran. He is a gifted evangelist. He is a church planter. And he says to these brethren, I need you to pray for me. And he said specifically, I want you to pray that God would open doors of opportunity for me, that God would give me opportunity to speak to others. I want to ask you this evening. Do you pray for that? When you got up this morning and you said a prayer to God and you thanked Him for the night of rest and the dawning of a new day, did you pray to God that prayer? Did you pray and say, God, today, would you open a door for me today that I can speak the gospel to somebody today? I think we need to do that. We need to pray for that interaction with our neighbor or with the other moms at a playgroup, or the individual who works in the cubicle next to me at work, or maybe the teacher in the room down the hall from where you are, or maybe your friend in high school or college. We need to pray that God would open a door of opportunity to just say something that would introduce the subject of God or faith or hope or religion or church or the Bible. I want you to notice, ladies and gentlemen, what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, look, I want you to pray that God will open a door so that I can speak to 62,421 people at Lucas Oil Stadium on a Sunday. He doesn't say that. You know why? Because you're not going to get to do that. But to say something to the person by whom you've worked for years, or somebody by whom you've lived for years, or some member of your family that you have known all of your life? Absolutely. And so he says, I want you to pray for an opportunity. And he said, I want you to pray also for wisdom, that I will know what to say, that I will have the words, that I will know what to say. I think that's a good prayer. Because if you've been a Christian very long, I'll guarantee you, you've been in the circumstance where you know that an opportunity is being provided for you. You've been there, haven't you? Where you're in a situation with somebody and you're talking with them and you know this is an open door. This is an opportunity to say something to these individuals about God or about faith or about the Bible. And we haven't really known what to say. Now, I tell you what you can always do in that circumstance is you can talk about your life and about what Christianity means to you and how it's real and relevant to you, because nobody can argue with that. That has credibility with people. You can't refute that. I've used as an illustration about that for a while now. When I moved to Temple Terrace, Florida, 25 and a half years ago now, I've been there a long time. But when I first moved there, the first week that I was there, upon the recommendation of somebody, I started using a dry cleaner in our community. And I've used the same dry cleaner ever since. And when I first started going to it, the business was owned by a dad, kind of the patriarch in a family. And he was a crusty, gruff old guy. He was just gruff. He was just rough. I always got along pretty well with him, but he just kind of had a rough way about him. Well, eventually he passed away. And so his son inherited the business. And his son was the polar opposite of his dad. His son loves everybody. His son is friendly and outgoing. He's gregarious. He likes all of his customers. His customers all love him. They enjoy talking to him. He's just a happy guy. But one day I went into my dry cleaners to drop some things off, and something was clearly wrong. And so I said, Mark, what's bothering you today? I said, something clearly is not right today. And he said, oh, Don, he said, it's my wife. He said, she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. And he said, it's really, really serious. And I said, well, Mark, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I told him, I said, Mark, you know what? I said, now, I've never had cancer. My wife's never had cancer. I said, but my mom and dad had cancer. And I said, I'll tell you what, Mark, what got me through that was my faith and prayer. And I said, what's your wife's name? And he said, well, their name is Valinda. And I said, well, Mark, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray for Valinda. And I said, you know, there's so many of the people in our congregation, our church, who come in here and they all know you. And I said, I'm going to ask the people that I know who know you, I'm going to ask them to pray for Valinda as well. And so as I would go in from time to time, I'd ask him, I'd say, well, how's Valinda doing? Well, she went through treatment and she went through surgery and then she went through some radiation. And I went in one day and I said, well, Mark, how's Valinda? And he said, Don, he said, she's been told that she's cured, that she is cancer free. And I said, well, thank God for that, Mark. I said, that is wonderful. And I said, that's the answer to a lot of prayer. Well, lo and behold, about two Sundays later, in between Bible class and worship, there's a little tiny diminutive lady standing in our foyer in our building, and she's visiting with one of our couples, and I go up and I stick my hand out and I said, hey, it's great to have you here. I'm Don Truex. And she said, well, I'm Valinda Kornheiser. And I said, are you Mark's Valinda? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, man, we have been praying for you. And she said, I know you have. One of our older couples took Belinda under their wing, and they took her in and sat with her, and then they began to study the Bible with her. And lo and behold, in about 6 weeks, Belinda was baptized into Christ. Now Mark, on the other hand, her husband, Mark, his last name is Kornheiser. He is from a Jewish family. Nobody in his family has ever left Judaism, ever. And so when this couple would study with his wife, Belinda, often they would do it at Belinda's home, Mark and Belinda's home, and they would tell me that Mark wouldn't come into the room. He would stay, he'd be in another room, but they knew that he was listening. And then it got to the point that he not only was listening, but he was giving questions to Belinda to ask while he listened in the other room. And then one day, lo and behold, I get up to preach and I look out and there is Mark sitting by Belinda. Mark, who is Jewish, has never been in a building like this in his life. And so I, as you might imagine, had some things to say that day about Jesus being the fulfillment of messianic prophecy and being the Christ who was to come. And in about 3 months, Mark was baptized. And they are as faithful today as they can be in serving God. And it began, ladies and gentlemen, because I just found a way to introduce faith in a non-obtrusive way to him. We're going to pray for your wife because this is what we do. This is what we've done for others that we love. We all can do that, ladies and gentlemen. If we try, we need to pray for opportunities and pray for wisdom to know what to say and then just pray for God's help. And we need to involve God in that process. As Paul would say, look, who is Paul and who is Apollos? All we are ministers through whom you believe as the Lord gave to each one. And yes, I planted, and yes, Apollos watered, but it is God who gives the increase. And so when individuals are obedient to the gospel, we need to rejoice in that and give God the credit because you and I did not die for anyone. And so number one, Paul says, consider your God. Secondly, he says, I want you to consider your connections. I want you to consider those to whom you have ties who don't share Christian faith with you as yet. Now here's where he said that. I want you to walk in wisdom toward those. Look at this word. Who are on the outside, redeeming the time. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. Now I realize, ladies and gentlemen, that is extraordinarily politically incorrect. And yet Paul says when it comes to salvation, there are some who are in Christ and some who are outside of Christ. Now in American culture, that won't fly because we live in a world where everybody gets a trophy and a snow cone and I'm okay, you're okay, we're all okay, God loves us anyway. And Paul says, I'm sorry, that's not it. There are some who are on the outside. And so we've got to think about that. Spiritually, God has divided the world in those who are saved and those who are lost. Now here's part of our problem with that. Part of our problem with that is that neighbor who is so friendly, that coworker who is so helpful, that fellow student who is so brilliant, that family member that is so loved, we forget sometimes that if they've never been obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ, they are, what's the Bible word? Lost. But it's easy because of our ties to people not to ever think in those terms. And so Paul says, I want you to consider your connections. So here's what you do about that. Number one, you build some relationships with those who are not Christians. Did you notice in that passage, ladies and gentlemen, that Paul just assumes that we are going to have some relationships with non-Christians? He says, I want you to walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. He assumes that we're going to have some relationship with people who are not Christians. I think sometimes as Christians, we believe that the perfect situation would be is if we never had to rub elbows with a non-Christian. If we could just wake up in the morning in our gated Christian community and get in our job and go to a workplace where there are only Christians and on the way home stop at a grocery store that was only populated and run by Christians and then go back to our gated Christian community and be inside there, that would be a wonderful thing. And Paul says, no, it wouldn't at all. In fact, Paul said to the Philippians, you've got to shine among whom you shine as lights in the world. That's what he's saying. And so we've got to purposely try to interact with those who as yet do not know God. And then we got to, again, we got to walk through those open doors. That is, when opportunity knocks, we've got to answer. Remember what Paul said? I become all things to all men. He did not. You know. You're good Bible students. You know. He was not implying in that he was going to sacrifice his principles or his morality or his values or his character. But he was saying that he was going to try to be positively involved in individuals' lives. That's what Jesus did, ladies and gentlemen. You remember that one of the accusations that was made continually against Jesus was he eats with tax collectors and sinners. Jesus, what do you say about that? And he would say, guilty as charged. He said, that's exactly right. That's what I do. Why would you do that, Jesus? Well, because those who are well don't need a physician, but those who are sick. And he said, I'm come to try to help people who need to be made spiritually well, come to have a relationship with God. And so we've got to consider our connections. And then third, Colossians 4 says, we've got to consider our words. And here's where it says that in verse 6. Look what it says. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. I want you to think about that little passage with me. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, so that you can know how you ought to answer each one. In other words, Paul is saying, listen, what you say and how you say it will speak volumes to others about who you are. Let me say that again. What you say and how you say it will speak volumes to others about who you are. If you don't believe that, just think about the 26th division of Matthew's gospel when Peter is warming his hands at the enemy's fire. There's just a little maiden girl. She's just a servant girl. And she's listening to him talk and she says, you must have been with a Galilean because you sound like a Galilean. Your words say something about you. Well, it does. I got to tell you, you listen to somebody who has lived the entirety of their life in Boston, Massachusetts, and bring them to Tampa, Florida, and they stand out a little bit. But we all do. What we say and how we say it speaks volumes to others about who we are. Let your speech always be with what? What is that word? Well, it's grace. We sing the song Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Bible says a lot about sin and judgment. And we should never try to sand the edges off of that to make it more palatable to the world. But by the same token, we've got to let the world know that God does have grace. And He does have sufficient grace to cover any sin that you have committed. We've got to be the people who hold out hope to a world that often feels there is no hope at all. And He says, you need to know how to answer each one. Did you notice that? Each one. Because we are individuals. We are not one size fits all. We are not clones of each other. And so we've got to think about the best way to approach each individual with the gospel. Because we can't just do it all the same. Now the gospel's the same. Don't misunderstand me about that. The gospel is always the same. That doesn't change. But how we interact with individuals, we have to think about them. I mean, some people, for example, some people are very analytical. They want everything laid out in logical, sequential order. They want everything to go from point A to point B to point C to point D, and then they can draw a logical, to them, rational conclusions. And so you've got to present the gospel that way. This makes sense. Everything leads into one thing. Some people are the polar opposite of that. Some people are emotional, extremely emotional. And for those individuals, the story of the cross, the just dying for the unjust, God sacrificing a child for us, for that, for some, that will move them mightily. Some individuals, probably most, I would say, are skeptical. And they want to know, I want you to listen carefully now, they want to know, what does Christianity mean to you? I think probably most individuals are right there. Most individuals, when we begin talking with them about the gospel, I think probably most of them are saying, you know what, you're asking me to radically change my life. All right, fair enough, okay? But first, I want to know, what does Christianity mean to you? How's it changed you? What's it done to your life? Does it make you happy? Does it make you sad? Has it made you a better husband, a better wife, a better son, a better daughter, a better employee, or a better employer? Has it made you a better person? What has Christianity done for you? You're asking me to change my life. All right. But what has it done for you? And I got to tell you, we're not very comfortable with that. You know what we're comfortable with? We want to begin here. Let me give you my 10 reasons why baptism is essential to salvation. Let me give you my 5 reasons why we don't use an instrument of music in worship. Let me give you my 8 reasons why we believe that Calvinism is wrong. Let me give you, and we want to give them argumentation, and most people just want to begin with, look, you're asking me to radically change my life. And they're sitting there thinking, how's it changed your life? What difference has it made to you? And I got to tell you, I think we're not always very comfortable talking about that. So, consider your God. Consider your connections. Consider your words. Now with that, if I can just segue away from that for a moment, I want to take the last very few minutes that we have this afternoon. And I want to talk to you about some things that everybody can do in evangelism. Several years ago, when we moved into a new building, much like you did, about the same time, actually. I think about 15 years ago. And when we did that, we invited some men to come and speak to us who had had great success in evangelism in the congregations where they were. And one of them who came, in one of his lessons, just in passing, he said, you know what, there are 4 things that everybody can do in evangelism. And he ticked them off like that, and he moved on. And I thought, wow, wait a minute, man, we need to talk about that. And so I've taken those 4 things and I've tried to think about them. And we try to keep these 4 things in front of our congregation. I preach about them every year at home. And we made bookmarks that we pass out. We put them on our screen. We try to keep these in front of the church because these are 4 things that everybody can do. And again, it doesn't matter if you're 8 years old or 18 years old or 80 years old. You can do these 4 things. It doesn't matter what your degree of education is. It doesn't matter how long you've been a Christian. You can do these 4 things. Let me mention them to you quickly, and then the lesson will be yours tonight. Here they are. Number 1, everybody can shine. Everybody can do that. You can do that. That doesn't take any special skill. In fact, Jesus said, look, you've got to do that. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and thereby glorify your Father who is in heaven. Well, everybody's going to sign on to that. Nobody's going to argue with that. Jesus is just saying, look, regardless of where you are, what circumstance you may find yourself, you make sure that you conduct yourself in such a way that the gospel is enhanced by your life and never diminished. Now, Jesus isn't the only one who said that, right? So Paul would write to his young protege Titus in Titus 2. And he said, Titus, I want you to say something to older women and older men and young women and young men. And he says, now here's what I want you to tell them. In verse 3, he said, I want you to tell them to live in such a way that nobody, by virtue of looking at their life, can malign the gospel. In verses 6, 7, and 8, he said, you tell them to live in such a way that one who is an opponent, somebody who hates Christianity, if they look at your life, they don't have anything to accuse Christianity of or Christians of by virtue of what they see in your life. You live in a way that you shine. In Philippians 1, verse 27, Paul put it this way. He said, I want you to conduct yourself worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the passage that we read a moment ago, Paul said, I want you to walk worthy of the gospel. Well, that's all that is. It's just living a good Christian life. You don't have to have special skill to do that. That's just who we are as Christians. It's learning to filter our life through the lens of what God would have us do. We talked about that this morning. 1 John chapter 2. By this we know that we know Him, if we keep His commandments, if we just do what God said to do. Could I say this as kindly and yet as plainly as I know how? Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest damage that is done to the cause of Christ in 2019 America, the greatest harm that is done to Christianity today is not by the immorality in Hollywood. It is not by the corruption in Washington, D.C., It's done. The greatest damage is done by Christians who come together on Sunday and they sing, oh, how I love Jesus, and then on Monday live in a decidedly different way. And Paul says, we've got to rise above that. That's what Jesus says. Everybody can shine. Secondly, everybody can speak. Now, I just lost some of you when I put that on the screen. I know that. You see, the first one, shine. Yeah, I can live a good Christian life. Speak, not so sure about that one, Don. And so I know that I just lost a good percentage of you. But let me tell you what I mean by that. I'm not saying that everybody should be able to stand in front of an audience and preach. I'm not saying that everybody should be able to stand in front of a Bible class and teach. Quite frankly, I don't want everybody to do that. I'll be out of a job. So you don't have to do that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, that every single one of us can learn to season our speech with references to God or faith or the Bible or church if we'll just think about it. Now, Jesus talked about that, by the way, in Matthew 10 and beginning in verse 32 when he said, therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who's in heaven. Now, you know, you're good Bible students again, so you know that's not the confession before baptism. If you want that confession, you go over to Romans chapter 10, right? With the heart man believes into righteousness, and with the mouth confession is made into salvation. That's not what he's talking about here. In this context, he says, whoever denies me before men, him will I also deny before my Father is in heaven. But whoever confesses me before men, I'll confess before my Father. That is, whoever owns me, just in daily life, if you're willing to own me, defend me, claim me, live up to your name, not be ashamed of who you are as my child. And I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we can do that if we'll just think about it. I think our problem along this line is that we've never been really taught or told to try to think in those terms. How in just casual conversation, in a non-obtrusive, not off-putting way, try to incorporate concepts of God or faith or truth or the Bible or church or church family into our conversation. We can do that if we'll just think about it. In Temple Terrace, where I live, there's a Starbucks about 3 minutes from my house. I stop there every morning of the world on my way to the office. If I'm in Temple Terrace, I stop there every single day. Now, I'm not addicted to caffeine. I just have to have it every day multiple times. And so I stop there every day. That Starbucks opened in August of 1999. I remember because I was driving by and I saw the sign going up and I pulled off to the side of the road and offered a prayer of thanksgiving for that. And so I go into that Starbucks all the time. Now, if you know anything about Starbucks stores, they go through managers kind of like water. I mean, just really one after another. And that store has had countless managers, some good, some bad. But they had one lady who was there for a good long while. Her name was Wendy. And Wendy came from the Windy City. She came from Chicago. Well, I went to my last 2 years of high school outside of Chicago. And so Wendy and I, we would talk a lot about the city. We talked about Chicago. We talked about a lot of things up there that we liked, that we enjoyed. And Wendy was just a big, happy, gregarious lady. And I really liked her. She was a great manager. And so we got along wonderfully. So one morning, very early, I go in there every Sunday morning, very early in the morning. And she liked to work on Sunday mornings because nobody was in there. And so I was in there one morning, and it was just Wendy and me. And so, you know, I'm dressed to go to my office. I'm dressed for Sunday morning. And I said, Wendy, I said, listen, I come and see you where you work all the time. When are you going to come and see me where I work? And she said, oh, Don, she said, if I came into a church building, the roof would just collapse. And I said, well, Wendy, we got a pretty strong roof. I think you could even handle Hurricane Wendy. I really do. And she said, no, Don, I don't think so. Thanks, but no thanks. I said, okay. Well, 2 or 3 weeks later, I didn't say anything for a couple of weeks, but about 3 weeks later, I was in there. It was just the two of us again on a Sunday morning. And I said, Wendy, listen, I'm serious. I come and see you all the time where you work. I want you to come see me where I work. And she said, well, I'll think about it. I said, okay, you think about it. Well, lo and behold, about two Sunday mornings later, in between Bible class and worship, I look up, and there's Wendy, and she's standing against the back wall of our auditorium. And so I walked back, and I smiled, and I said, Wendy, man, we are so happy that you are here today. And she said, Don, I know so many of these people. I said, yeah, we're all addicted to caffeine here, man. Of course you know us. And I said, Wendy, come down here and sit with Vicky and me. So she came down, and she sat with us. And, of course, people just embraced her and enveloped her and made her feel welcome. And I asked Wendy, I said, Wendy, would you study the Bible with me? And she said, yeah, I would. I got to tell you, Wendy had a lot to overcome. She had lived a rough life. She was living with a man to whom she was not married. We began to study the Bible, and she began to understand that there was a better way to live your life. And she began to understand that there was a God in heaven, a Father in heaven, whose grace could forgive even her. And about 6 weeks later, I offered the invitation one Sunday morning, where there came Wendy down the aisle. We got up in the baptistry, and we're standing there in the baptistry, and I'm trying to tell this story to the church, right? I'm trying to tell about Wendy and how we got here, and I'm crying. I'm crying like a baby up there. And Wendy is looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And finally, I got it all out, and I baptized her. 18 months later, I performed Wendy's wedding ceremony to a wonderful young Christian man. And it all came about because I just found a way to invite her to come and see that was not off-putting to her, embarrassing to her, and really was comfortable for her. We can all do that if we'll just think about it. I just think, ladies and gentlemen, that often we don't think in those terms. And I got to tell you why that's interesting to me. What's interesting to me about that is that we don't have any difficulty talking about things that interest us, right? And so we can talk about sports. I mean, we talk about the Colts. We talk about, I'm an IU graduate. I can talk about IU sports. Some of you are Purdue graduates, and we will pray for you and pray that God's grace and mercy will be sufficient for you. But you don't have any trouble talking about that. I mean, we don't have any trouble talking about our kids. And we sure don't have any difficulty talking about our grandkids, do we? Because those things are important to us. And we say that the most important thing in the world to us is our relationship with God and with His Son, Jesus Christ. And if that's true, ladies and gentlemen, we shouldn't have any difficulty talking about those things. We don't have any trouble talking about things that matter to us, kids, especially grandkids. That same Starbucks, by the way. I pulled up to that Starbucks. This was about a year, maybe a year and a half ago. And there was something different that morning because the parking spaces going into the Starbucks are all just like this. But there were two big Chevy Tahoes, and they were parked horizontally. And they had blacked out windows. And there was a gentleman standing outside of one of them. And he had on a suit, and he had an earpiece in his ear, and he had sunglasses on. And I went inside, and there were two other gentlemen in there, and they were in suits, and they had sunglasses on, and they had an earpiece, and they were standing off to the side, and they were watching the line. Now, I got to tell you, Starbucks coffee is expensive, but I mean, even that, you don't have to guard it that way. I mean, so I knew that something was going on in there. So I stepped up in line, and when I did, the gentleman in front of me turned around, and he smiled and he stuck out his hand and he said, I'm Rick Scott. What's your name? And I said, well, Governor, I know who you are. I voted for you. And I said, I'm Don Truex. And he said, well, it's nice to meet you. I said, well, it's good to meet you, Governor. I said, what brings you to Tampa? I said, you're a long way from Tallahassee today. And he said, oh, Don, he said, I'm here to dedicate a building over on the campus of USF. But he said, let me tell you why I'm really glad that I'm in Tampa today. He said, today is my grandson's second birthday. And he and his family live here in Tampa. And he said, I'm going to get to go to my grandson's second birthday party today. And I said, well, that's very nice, Governor. And then he asked me the magic question. He said, Don, do you have any grandchildren? Yes, I do, Governor. And I took out my phone. And I began to show the governor my grandkids, and he began to show me his grandkids, and I'm going to tell you right now, my grandkids are a lot better looking than the governor's. But I didn't have any trouble talking to the governor of the state of Florida about my grandkids. Why? Because those kids are everything to me. And we say that God and his son Jesus Christ and their word, and our church family, our faith, we say that those are the most important things in the world to us. If it is, ladies and gentlemen, then we should be able to talk about those things. We should be able to do that fairly easily. We need to give glory to God for the good things in our life. We need to let hurting people know that we'll pray for them because we believe that that prayer matters, that faith matters. We need to speak. And third, we need to invite. Everybody can do that. The easiest thing you will ever do in evangelism is invite somebody to come to worship with you. It is the most non-threatening, easy thing you will ever do in evangelism. I love this passage out of John 1. This is wonderful, isn't it? Philip found Nathanael, and he said to him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And Philip said, come and see. I love that passage. Now, every time I read that passage, what I'm always reminded of is, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? I can't read that passage without remembering that when I was a student all those years ago at Florida College, we nicknamed the cafeteria Nazareth because no good thing could ever come out of there. But that's really not germane to the point that we need to make tonight. The final phrase was, come and see. Just come and see. They didn't say, look, we want to present some argumentation to you. We're going to give you 10 logical reasons why Jesus could, in fact, be the fulfillment of Messianic. They didn't do any of that. They just said, come and see. Ladies and gentlemen, the easiest thing you will ever do in evangelism is just invite somebody to come and see. You know that you can invite your friends, you can invite family members to come to worship with you in this place, and you know they're not going to be embarrassed. You know that Lanny is never going to shy away from truth, but by the same token, you know that he's going to speak the truth in love. The easiest thing we'll ever do is just say, come and see. You know, Jesus said, go into all the world. I think sometimes we use that phrase to let ourselves off the hook. Going to all the world. Well, I can't do that. No way in the world that I could go to India. I can't go to Ethiopia. I can't go to the Philippines. I can't go into all the world. But you know, don't you? Again, you're good Bible students. You know that what Jesus is saying is, look, I want you to go into your world. I want you to go where you do life. I mean, go into your workplace. Go into your neighborhood. Go to your rec center. Go wherever it is you do life. Tell people about me. Invite. If you invite somebody to come to worship with you, what is the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that could happen is that they might say, no thanks. Would that be so soul-shattering that we couldn't get over it? I think we can handle that. Again, it's the easiest thing you'll ever do. And then when non-Christians come into our assembly, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to welcome them. We don't ever talk about that, but could I say just one word about that, just very quickly? We don't have time tonight. I'm out of time, so I'm just going to just say this quickly. In James chapter 2, I know there's a context here. And the context is, you know, that is respect of persons. So there comes into your assembly somebody and they're well-dressed and they've got jewelry hanging all off of them. And you are impressed by that and you give them a great, prominent place. But there's somebody who comes in and they're not very well-dressed and you're not sure about them. And so you put them in the back corner. James says, have you not become a judge and respecter of persons in doing that? Now, that's the context. But, now, listen, don't put everything away yet because I'm not really quite finished. Y'all putting everything away. I can hear you just rustling papers and, you know, putting your shoes on. All that. Don't do that. I'll give you a heads up in just a minute. That's the context of James 2. But have you ever thought about what's implied in James 2? If they're coming to your assembly a man in fine apparel with gold rings, and they're also coming to your assembly a man who is not well dressed, the implication is James is saying, look, it should be natural that we're going to have guests come into our assembly. Now, the only way that's going to happen, by the way, is if we do number three and invite, right? I don't know if you noticed this morning, but we did not have 100 people in our assembly this morning who were just driving past the building and thought, you know, I think I'm going to stop in there today and see what's going on. Now, that may happen occasionally. But if we're going to have guests into our assembly, primarily it's going to be because we invite. And James says, when visitors come into our assembly, how we treat them is going to make all the difference in the world. And it does. How we treat guests in our assembly makes all the difference in the world. All survey research data indicates that visitors who come into our assembly, who are non-Christians, who are non-church, that they all decide within the first 5 minutes whether or not they will ever return or not. And so we've got to make sure, man, you see somebody you don't recognize, speak to them, introduce yourself to them. Make them welcome. Now, by the way, I said that in a place once, and a lady came to me as soon as service was over. She came up to me and she said, you know what, Don? I did that. Saw somebody I didn't know. I went up and introduced myself, and the lady said, I've been a member of this church for a year and a half. And I said, that's great. You met somebody tonight you should have met a year and a half ago. We've got to think about non-Christian visitors to our service. And what that's like for them. Do you know what that's like? What's it like for a non-Christian visitor to come into our assembly? It's like this. When Vicki and I lived in Indianapolis, every year, we would go to Butler's campus and we would see some production that was put on by their drama department. Well, imagine that you've gone over to Butler to see a performance and you're sitting there, and it's almost time for the curtain to rise, and so the audience is all in place, and it's kind of quiet. And there's a gentleman who comes, he comes from up in the front from behind the curtain, and he walks out down an aisle, and he comes to you, and he says, you, sir, who came in late tonight, could you come with me? And so he comes up to you, and he says, come with me. And so you get up, and you follow him, and he takes you up on stage behind the curtain. And you notice that all the other actors are taking their place and all the props are in place and everybody is set. And the gentleman says to you, he says, I am the director of tonight's performance. And one of our actors is called in sick and I need you to take their place. And he walks away from you. And the curtain rises. And everybody on stage begins to move and hit their marks and say their lines, and you are completely lost because you don't have any idea what you're supposed to do. That's a non-Christian visitor to our worship services. You see, we all know what's going to happen. We know the order it's going to happen. We're comfortable with that. But a non-Christian visitor to our service, they don't know anything about that. They don't know what's going to happen at all. It's why we need to make sure that we welcome them. Invite them to come sit with us. Tell them what's going to happen. Tell them what the order of things is going to be so that they can be comfortable. This isn't hard. You know, sometimes Bible studies can be hard. Sometimes difficult questions are challenging, but that's not what this is. This is just shining, speaking, inviting. Welcoming. And we can do that. That's our task, ladies and gentlemen. Introduce people to Jesus. What they do with Jesus afterwards is up to them. Our task is introduce them to the Savior. The Apostle Paul, one of his writings, said that the sound of the gospel had gone forth through the habitable world. I find that amazing. How in the world did that happen? How was it that in the first century the gospel spread to the habitable world? without a single billboard, no correspondence courses. There were no websites, no Facebook, no Instagram, no Twitter. There was no text messaging. There was no television. There were no CDs, no DVDs. There was no Bible class material other than whatever text that they had. How did they do that? It happened because the individuals, those Christians, who read the book and knew the author of the book, and like both, told others. It happened because one hungry person who knew where the bread line was told another hungry person. We can do that. Okay, I've taken extra minutes tonight. I promise you I will give them back to you one night this week. How about you this evening? So maybe you're in this audience and you've just never responded to what we've been talking about tonight. There will never be a better time or opportunity for you to become a Christian than tonight. You can be buried in the water of baptism. You can rise to walk in newness of life. Maybe you've done that. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you haven't been faithful to God. As we said this morning, you know, the question is, what will you do with Jesus? Maybe as a Christian, you haven't lived up to the name that you wear. You can take care of that tonight. And so if there's a response to God that you need to make in a public way tonight, and we can help you, we hope you'll let us. Let's stand. Let's sing.